Hello, everybody, and welcome into the Star Wars Legends Lounge, the show that celebrates the books from Star Wars Legends. I'm Aaron Motes. The Major League Baseball season is almost a month old. The Baltimore Orioles haven't started off quite as well as many of us fans had hoped, but I think they're about to start climbing up the division standings. Look, it's hard to win 100 games. Maybe they don't get to last year's win total, but I think the Birds are going to be a better team than they were last year. They get Kyle Bradish, they get John Means back, promote some of the big bats from AAA, and avoid injuries to some of their key players. And I still think this year's Baltimore Orioles can make it to the World Series. But listener, you didn't tune in to hear me talk about the O's. No, you want me to talk about today's book, Tales of the Bounty Hunters, edited by Kevin J. Anderson. It's the third anthology book published in Legends, but it's the first one that I've covered here on the podcast. The book contains five stories featuring the bounty hunters we see hired by Darth Vader to hunt for the Millennium Falcon in The Empire Strikes Back. But before I get to today's book, let's take a couple listener questions. I have two questions today. The first email comes from Mitch. Mitch says, "Hello, Aaron. I love the podcast. I have binge listened like mad, especially the Sith books. But I have a complaint. At the end of the Heir to the Empire trilogy, Thrawn is murdered out of the blue, pun intended, by his bodyguard. I find it a ridiculous twist for a guy that's playing 1,000 moves ahead of the others to not know the backstory of everyone in his command. I just find this ending for Thrawn not in the realm of possibility. What are your thoughts?" Well, thank you very much for the email, Mitch. Like you, the way Thrawn dies at the end of The Last Command doesn't sit very well for me, although I do find it within the realm of possibility. I don't have an issue with the Nogri secretly turning against Thrawn. I don't have an issue with Rook, his bodyguard, surprising Thrawn and killing him. It's just not as satisfying as I think the ending could have been if the New Republic outsmarted Thrawn, the tactical genius. I think that would have been a more artistic, pun intended, ending. The only thing that I would disagree with you with is that I don't think it's realistic for Thrawn to know everything about everyone under his command. That borders a bit on omnipotence for me, and while I do like how Thrawn is a very different kind of enemy for our heroes to go up against, I don't like the idea that he can never be outwitted. That whenever you play chess with Thrawn, you're always going to lose. But in general, Mitch, I agree that Thrawn's death at Rook's hand is not as satisfying as I think it probably could have been. Today's second email comes from Daryl, who says, "In episode 51 of the podcast, you're talking about the book Annihilation. When Tefeth shoots the door control panel, you said you were confused when, a few sentences later, someone uses the control panel to open the door. Well, what if her blaster was set to stun? Wouldn't that maybe act as an EMP, so to speak?" Thank you very much for the email, Daryl. Sure, your scenario could work. The text isn't really clear as to what the blaster was set to. Most of the time, when a blaster is set to stun in Star Wars, the author tells you that. So I just assumed that Tefeth had her blaster set at the normal setting. But your interpretation works. However, Daryl, I have one question for you. If a blaster set to stun could act as an EMP, wouldn't the control panel be dead? It may not be destroyed like the way I thought it was, but still, would there be any power left in the panel to open the door? I'm not saying there wouldn't be. I don't really know how long the effects of an EMP would remain. If you can explain it a little more to me, Daryl, I'd love to hear from you. Send me another email. Listener, if you have a question for the show, like Mitch and Daryl, you can email me at swlegendslounge@gmail.com or send me a tweet at legendslounge1. And if you'd like to get your voice on the show, just record a short message and email it in. But please record it in MP3 audio format. And listener, coming up at the end of the show, I've got a new Starfighter Squadron to share with you. You're going to want to hang around for that. But now it's time for today's book, Tales of the Bounty Hunters, edited by Kevin J. Anderson. Grab yourself a drink. Let's head in to the Star Wars Legends Lounge. Tales of the Bounty Hunters contains five stories that revolve around the search for the Millennium Falcon after the Battle of Hoth. Because of that, today's show is going to be a little different from my others. Because if I did my normal plot summaries for all five stories, you listeners would be bored out of your minds. So, the summaries are going to be very brief, and then I'll spend more time talking about what works for me and what doesn't after each one. Let's begin. The first story is called Therefore I Am, The Tale of IG-88, written by Kevin J. Anderson, who is most known to Legends fans as the author of the Jedi Academy trilogy. The story begins with IG-88 activating itself in an Imperial lab. IG-88 is one of five Imperial assassin droids in the lab. When it activates, it recognizes the scientists and stormtroopers as threats. The droid slaughters the lab personnel and then activates three of the other four assassin droids and implants them with its personality. The four IG-88s develop a plan to take over the galaxy by programming all the droids manufactured at the droid factories on the planet Mechas 3 to revolt when IG-88 gives the signal to kill their living masters. To keep attention away from Mechas 3, IG-88B is sent out into the galaxy to act as a bounty hunter. Eventually, IG-88B makes its way in front of Darth Vader and accepts the bounty on Han Solo. Before leaving Exegutor, IG-88B plugs into a computer port and learns about the construction of the second Death Star. IG-88A then decides to upload itself into the Death Star's computer core while IG-88B follows Han Solo to Bespin. On Cloud City, Boba Fett destroys the B model, causing IG-88C and IG-88D to chase after the Mandalorian bounty hunter. Boba Fett destroys IG-88C later on Tatooine, and Dash Rendar destroys IG-88D on Ord Mantell. The story ends about a year later. IG-88A has assimilated its personality into the Death Star. It's about to put its plan for galactic domination into motion, just as the Battle of Endor begins. My opinions on this story are mixed, but I would say of the five in the book, this one was less appealing to me than most of the others. I think there were two stories, in my opinion, that I enjoyed more than the other three. This would be in those three that I didn't enjoy as much. If you're a longtime listener to this show, you know that I am not as enamored with droids as many Star Wars fans. I love R2-D2. I appreciate C-3PO. The other droids, I can take it or leave it. So I have never been as enamored with IG-88 from back in the old original trilogy days, or, you know, his lookalike today, IG-11/12/13, from the Mandalorian TV show. However, there are some things in this story that I liked. My favorite part was the beginning, when IG-88 wakes up. It's told from the droid's point of view. You see through its eyes. It looks at many of the scientists in the lab, and it starts assessing the situation. There are four other droids in the lab. All of them look like IG-88. Three of the others clearly have not been programmed yet. So when IG-88 finally wakes up, assesses its situation, and determines that humans, while they may be its creator, would try to control the droid. And IG-88's programming allows it a belief in self-determination. That makes any outsider a threat, particularly the people in the lab, because those people are the ones trying to load specific programming instructions into the droids. So the beginning is about the first quarter of the story. The rest of it, the plan for galactic domination, wiping out the few people on Mechas 3, taking over the droid manufacturing facilities, and developing a plan to take over the galaxy by turning the droids against their owners, I don't find as interesting, mainly because the discussion around droid sentience has never been that interesting to me. For the most part, in the rest of the story, we follow IG-88B as it acts as a distraction in the galaxy. We don't really get much with IG-88C or D until the B model is destroyed, and then those two head out into the galaxy to hunt down Boba Fett for destroying their compatriot. They don't last long. Within a page, both of them are destroyed, one by Boba Fett, one by Dash Rendar of Shadows of the Empire fame. And finally, we're left with the original IG-88, who woke up at the beginning of the story, IG-88A, who decides to upload myself into the second Death Star, and that way I could have a more hands-on opportunity to jet around the galaxy and basically blow up whatever I wanted to blow up in order to rule the galaxy. Of course, the story ends as the Battle of Endor begins, and we know how that battle ends. So, we don't have to worry about IG-88 taking over the galaxy. If you like droids, if you like IG-88, this is a fine story. It moves pretty quickly. It's not very long. To me, it bogs down slightly in the middle when they go to Mechas 3, but for the most part, the pacing of the story is a pacing that I enjoy. I've said it before, I like stories that move, and this one does. The second story is called Payback, The Tale of Dengar, by Dave Wolverton, who was the author of The Courtship of Princess Leia. The story begins with Dengar taking the job to assassinate an Imperial official. When Dengar catches the officer, he sees a vision of his old obsession, Han Solo. Years ago, Han and Dengar competed in a high-stakes swoop race. Just before the finish line, Han cut off Dengar, causing the bounty hunter to crash. The Empire put Dengar back together, removing parts of his brain that felt positive emotions. After his recovery, Dengar vowed to get revenge on Solo. The opportunity presents itself as Darth Vader offers a bounty for Solo and the Millennium Falcon. Dengar follows the Falcon to Cloud City, but loses out to Boba Fett. Enraged, Dengar searches for Fett around the galaxy, eventually following the Mandalorian to Tatooine. Finally, hoping to get his revenge on Solo, Dengar tries to plant a bomb in Jabba the Hutt's throne room. But his plan backfires, and Jabba orders Boba Fett to take Dengar deep into the Dune Sea and chain him to the ground, subjecting him to the teeth of Tatooine. The wind and sharp rocks start cutting Dengar apart, but the bounty hunter eventually works himself free. Dengar is rescued by one of Jabba's dancing girls, Manaroo. They find the wreckage of Jabba's sail barge at the Great Pit of Carcoon and discover a burnt, naked man, still alive, lying on the sand. Of course, it's Boba Fett. Dengar starts to strangle the Mandalorian, but Manaroo stops him. The story ends with Dengar and Boba Fett agreeing to put aside their rivalry, with Fett agreeing to be the best man at Dengar and Manaroo's wedding. So this was one of the two stories in the book that I enjoyed the most. I would say the second one was my favorite, but this one was right up there. Dengar, a lot of times, is the butt of jokes in the Star Wars community. Some of the best ones are in some of the Lego Star Wars movies and Lego Star Wars shorts, where Dengar is portrayed as kind of a bumbling idiot. We get some of his Legends backstory here, where Han Solo causes Dengar's swoop to crash. Dengar is almost killed, but the Empire realizes that if they can put Dengar back together while doing some creative elective surgery to his eyes, to his ears, amplifying his senses, and of course his brain, they could create kind of a super soldier, but with plausible deniability for the Empire. Of course, because he's kind of a free agent, that allows Dengar to take other jobs. And at the beginning of the story, he has taken a job for the regular citizens of a planet. This is the first time where we see Dengar's obsession with Han Solo, and the first time where we realize that Dengar is not really 100% mentally stable. He catches the Imperial officer. He starts shaking the man. And as he's shaking him, he sees Han Solo's face. He starts screaming at what he thinks is Han Solo. And while the officer is terrified for his life, he's also terrified that Dengar has just gone insane. He doesn't have to worry about being afraid very long because, of course, Dengar completes his contract. I like the parts where Dengar talks to Manaroo, the dancing girl. Manaroo doesn't react to Dengar like most people. She doesn't shy away from him when he walks into a room. She doesn't appear terrified or disgusted by what he looks like. You know, the surgeries have kind of messed his face up. That's why he covers the bottom half of his face so much. Manaroo knows that Dengar is not a good man, but she believes there's a good man inside of him, that he can be a better person if he wants to be. And credit to Dengar, he starts a period of self-reflection. Can I be a better person? Still, his rage, his obsession normally gets the better of him. When Boba Fett gets the jump on him in Cloud City, part of the obsession with capturing and killing Han Solo then is transferred to Boba Fett. But still, he thinks about some of the things that Manaroo said about trying to become a better person. In the end, after Dengar frees himself from the teeth of Tatooine and he's able to meet up with Manaru again at Jabba's palace. When they travel to the Great Pit of Carkoon and discover the destruction, and they find Boba Fett right after he escapes from the Sarlacc, Manaru is able to cut through Dengar's rage, Dengar's pain. And again, while he is physically incapable of feeling joy, Dengar still knows right from wrong. And Dengar knows if you want to try to become a better person, part of that is forgiving others and forgiving himself. Manaru is able to help him see that. And the story ends with he and Boba Fett calling a truce to their bounty hunting rivalry. I really enjoyed the theme of this story. I really enjoyed, even though Dengar can't really feel hope, I enjoyed the story of hope within this tale. Time to take a break. When I return, I'll talk about the last three stories in Tales of the Bounty Hunters. I'm Aaron Motes. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Star Wars Legends Lounge. Thank you for listening to the Star Wars Legends Lounge, where we celebrate the books from Star Wars Legends. But let me recommend a book from Star Wars canon. Jedi Battle Scars tells the story of Cal Kestis and the crew of the Stinger Mantis following the events of Jedi Fallen Order. The crew meets a former stormtrooper who has information that could prove crucial for the rebellion. But can the Imperial deserter be trusted? And can Cal evade pursuit from the evil Fifth Brother? Find out in Jedi Battle Scars by Sam Maggs. Welcome back to the Star Wars Legends Lounge, the show that celebrates the books from Star Wars Legends. I'm Aaron Motes, and today I'm talking about Tales of the Bounty Hunters, one of the Legends character anthology books, edited by Kevin J. Anderson. Story number three is called The Prize Pelt, The Tale of Bosk, written by Kathy Tyers, the author of The Truce at Bakura. Bosk accepts the bounty on Han Solo, not only for the credits, but for the joy of hunting the smuggler and the dastardly Wookiee, Chewbacca. After Darth Vader dismisses the bounty hunters, Bosk heads back to his ship. There, he finds a dark-furred Wookiee and a human female. The woman's name is Tinian, and she's a bounty hunter apprentice to the Wookiee, Chenlembek. The two had arrived on the Executor too late to take the bounty on Han Solo. But Tinian says they have information that Solo and Chewbacca are going to travel to the planet Lamabu 3 to liberate an Imperial Wookiee penal colony. Bosk is skeptical, but agrees to take the two bounty hunters aboard his ship. When Bosk locks the two in their cabin, they use a tiny spy droid to slice into the ship's computer. When the Houndstooth arrives at Lamabu 3, Chen and Tinian turn the tables on Bosk, trapping the Trandoshan in his cargo hold. They call the Imperial Governor and claim the bounty on Bosk. They attack the penal colony, free the Wookiees, and leave Bosk to rot in prison. I know the summary for this one was quick. I'll admit, this was my least favorite story in the book. The one part I thought was interesting was Bosk agreeing to work with Chenlembek and Tinian, considering how much Trandoshans and Wookiees hate each other. We know that Trandoshans hunt Wookiee pelts for status. It's the same in Legends as it is in canon. The two species are mortal rivals. So that was the most interesting part of this story for me. The rest of it, in my opinion, just kind of drags. The vast majority of the story is inside Bosk's ship, where he's trying to figure out how to use the information that Chen and Tinian have offered in order to capture Han Solo, capture Chewbacca, and then take some of the pelts from the Wookiees at the penal colony. Of course, intending to double-cross Tinian and Chanlenbeck. We know that the two bounty hunters who are traveling on the Houndstooth are intending on double-crossing Bosk, using him to get to Lamabu 3, to the Wookiee penal colony, because, of course, they want to free the Wookiees. And they hope to then steal Bosk's ship and get the Wookiees out of there. I thought the story was a little plotting. There were times, particularly with the slicer droid, where the droid itself would try to tell some jokes, or maybe not jokes, but the droid was kind of the comedic relief, but I didn't think it was funny. The story ends with Bosk just being arrested and put in prison, with the two bounty hunters taking Bosk's ship. Later on in Legends, we know that Bosk gets the ship back, so he gets out of prison somehow. I don't exactly know how he gets out of prison, but I know there are later books where Bosk is out and he's flying the Houndstooth again. So he obviously gets out and he gets his ship back from Chanlenbeck and Tinian. I hate to say it because I try not to be very negative on this show, but I just found this story boring. That's all. It was just boring. There were a couple interesting discussions between Bosk and Tinian, who was translating for Chanlenbeck. But other than those, I don't know, this story just didn't hold my attention as much as the others in the book. Now, the fourth story is called Of Possible Futures, The Tale of Zuckuss and Forlom by M. Shane Bell, whose other contributions to Star Wars Legends are stories in two of the other Tales of books, Tales from the Mos Eisley Cantina and Tales from Jabba's Palace. Right off the bat, before I go into the summary, I'm going to let you know, I call him Forlom. I know some people call him 4LOM, but I call the droid Forlom. Now, the story begins with Zuckuss and Forlom taking the bounty to find Han Solo in order to pay for Zuckuss's medical bills. The Gan's lungs are scarred from accidentally inhaling oxygen, and now he's slowly getting weaker. While meditating, Zuckuss sees the Millennium Falcon meeting up with the Rebel fleet above the galactic plane. He devises a plan to infiltrate the fleet by rescuing some of the survivors of Hoth. Now, those survivors are on the Bright Hope, the last Rebel transport to flee the planet. Led by Controller Torrin Farr, a small band of Rebels group together in the only area of the transport that still has life support. However, it's quickly running out. Zuckuss and Forlom convince the Imperials to allow them to rescue the Rebels on the Bright Hope and take them to the rendezvous point, which the bounty hunters promise to reveal to the Empire. When Zuckuss and Forlom enter the Bright Hope, they offer to save about 20 of the Rebels, but Torrin Farr refuses, accusing the two of choosing the survivors with the highest bounties on their heads. Torrin says the bounty hunters either take all of the survivors or none of them will go. Zuckuss finally agrees, much to Forlom's chagrin. Still, the bounty hunters intend to send the coordinates of the Rebel fleet back to the Imperials. Now, by the time they arrive at the rendezvous point, Zuckuss's lungs have gotten even worse. But, to their surprise, Leia Organa and General Ryken have the Gan admitted to one of the hospital ships. To show their gratitude for delivering the survivors of the Bright Hope, they offer to grow new lungs for Zuckuss. The story ends with the two bounty hunters agreeing to try to rescue Han Solo after Zuckuss is finished healing. This was my favorite story in the book. I've always liked the look of Zuckuss and Forlom from the first times I watched Empire Strikes Back. I think Zuckuss specifically, the Gand who breathes ammonia, so he's got that entire face shield on with a breathing tube allowing him to breathe his ammonia. There are echoes of Jedi teachings in this story. Zuckuss meditates a lot. One presumes it's to try to fend off the pain from his damaged lungs, but he also has found some peace in his meditations. They allow him to see possible futures. He gets a feeling that the Millennium Falcon is going to meet up with the rest of the Rebel fleet above the galactic plane. Which, of course, the reader then asks the question, does Zuckuss have some innate force ability? And maybe he doesn't realize it. Maybe he doesn't understand it. Or if he does, maybe he just decided he wasn't going to train as a force user. Or maybe he's just doing something different. Maybe it has nothing to do with the force. The other side of the story, when they would go to the scenes of the rebels trying to survive in the Bright Hope, I like the tension of those scenes. Torin Farr was a controller. She's not really in a position of leadership. However, she seems to be the highest ranking survivor alive on the ship. Even though she questions her ability to lead these people, to give them hope that someone will come back and rescue them, she steps up. She works through her doubt, her anxieties. She organizes the survivors into doing tasks like finding supplies on the parts of the ship that they can still get to setting up a triage for the injured, to getting some of the medical droids back working and focusing on the most injured of the survivors. I really enjoyed those scenes. As I said, there was a sense of tension. They were harrowing. And then on the flip side, you have Zuckuss and Forlom formulating this plan, telling the Empire that they will use some of the survivors in order to find the Millennium Falcon and sell the information to the Empire about where the Rebel fleet is. Of course, when they do bring the survivors aboard their ship, once they get to the rendezvous point, it's the gratitude and the generosity of the rebels, of the rebel leadership, of Princess Leia, of General Ryken, and then of Torin Farr, that changes Zuckuss's mind. And in so doing, also changes Forlom's mind. They don't want to turn these people in. They want these people to win over the Empire. Again, it's a story of hope. It's a story of being open to having your mind changed on some issue that you may be incorrect about. That's what I like about this story. And I think the fact that they tell it from two different points of view, they tell it from Zuckuss and Forlom's, and then they tell it from Torin Farr's, and they keep jumping back and forth between those points of view, keeps the story moving at a nice brisk pace, which I really like. Now, the final story in the book is called The Last One Standing, The Tale of Boba Fett by Daniel Keyes Moran, who also wrote for the Tales from the Mos Eisley Cantina and Jabba's Palace anthologies. This story spans decades. It starts with Boba Fett running into a young Han Solo before the smuggler joined the rebellion. It jumps ahead to after the Mandalorian delivers Solo to Jabba the Hutt, gets swallowed by, and then escapes the Sarlacc pit, and eventually makes his way off Tatooine. Jump ahead 15 years later, and Boba Fett captures a Deveronian war criminal, while Han finds himself free from Leia, Chewie, and the kids for a few days, and decides to visit one of his old stomping grounds. It's basically Han's midlife crisis. After Fett delivers the Deveronian for execution, he receives a signal about Solo returning to that old stomping ground on the planet Jubilar. Now, Boba Fett tracks Solo to a shop. When Han gets a feeling that something isn't right, he feels that it's a setup. He turns to leave the shop just as Fett shoots through a window and accidentally kills his informant. Boba Fett then chases Han out of the store and catches up with him outside. Both of them pull their weapons and freeze, the muzzles of their blasters only inches from each other. However, neither pulls the trigger. Staring each other down, the story ends with the two old adversaries agreeing to lower their weapons and walk away. This story was fine. I liked it more than the Bossk story. I thought it was a little more interesting than the IG-88 story, but I didn't like it as much as the other two. For those of you who may not know, because this is Legends, Boba Fett's real original identity was Jaster Mereel. There is some talk of that at the beginning of this story, but it quickly goes away, and he's just referred to as Boba Fett from the rest of the time there. Again, we see Han's personality shine through. Whenever he gets any free time, he shies away from a normal life, a boring life as a husband, a father, family man. He enjoys those things, but he still yearns for the freedom and excitement that being a smuggler allowed him back in the old days. We learn that Fett and Han first met on this planet Jubilar when Han was a late teenager. Now, it was mostly Han was a participant in a brawl, and Boba Fett was watching the brawl. For Boba Fett, Han was just a job. But in Legends, Boba Fett has this code of right and wrong. Not in an ethical or legal sense, but a moral sense. The reason Boba Fett doesn't like Han Solo isn't because he's a smuggler. It's because he smuggled spice, an intoxicant that can destroy people's lives. The Deveronian war criminal that he chases down, and I am not going to try to pronounce this name. It's more than a dozen letters long. It has a handful of apostrophes in it. But Boba Fett doesn't really have an issue with the Deveronian, although you could say what he did was much worse than what Han Solo did. The Deveronian took orders from the Empire to destroy a village of innocent people. In Boba Fett's point of view, the Empire is the legal government of the galaxy. So the Deveronian didn't do anything morally wrong. Han Solo and the Rebellion were in the wrong for trying to overthrow the legal government. Han Solo himself was in the wrong for trying to smuggle something that could destroy people's lives. At the end of the story, when Boba Fett tries to take Han out, the two fight, neither gets the upper hand, and they end the book with the two adversaries standing there, their blasters touching each other's chests, and then deciding to walk away. It was fine. I think in the one or two things the two say to each other in that moment, the reader doesn't really get any character insights to show that they quashed the grudge they have against each other. It just ends. They lower their weapons and they leave. And while I like that characters have a certain code, characters live their lives a certain way, that they have their own sense of what is right or wrong, I think the way Boba Fett's is portrayed in this story doesn't really work for me. However, you reader, if you like Boba Fett tales, if you have any interest in who Boba Fett was prior to the movie Attack of the Clones, when we see Boba Fett's canon origin, if you have any interest in when he was somebody different, when he was the journeyman Jester Mereel, give this story a try. And there are other stories about Jester Mereel in Legends as well. Now, it's almost time to go, but first, I've got a new Star Wars fighter squadron to share. Today's squadron comes from Harry in Australia. Harry is calling his group Royal Squadron. Here we go. Goldflight, the leader, Royal 1, is Luke Skywalker in an X-Wing fighter. Royal 2 is Leia Organa in an N1 starfighter. Royal 3, Din Djarin, also in an N1. And Royal 4, Rick Ali, also in an N1 starfighter. Silverflight. Royal 5 is Hera Syndulla in a B-Wing starfighter. Royal 6 is Sabine Wren, and Royal 7, Tally Lintra, both flying A-Wings. And Royal 8 is Anakin Skywalker and Ahsoka Tano in a two-person Y-Wing bomber. Bronze Flight features Royal 9, Wedge Antilles, Royal 10, Biggs Darklighter, Royal 11, Poe Dameron, and Royal 12, Antok Merrick, all flying X-Wing starfighters. And finally, Platinum Flight consists of Royal 13, Cassian Andor, K2SO, Bistan, and Melshi in a U-Wing. Royal 14 is Oddball flying a Republic gunship carrying Captain Rex and Delta Squad. Royal 15 is Hawk in a Z-95 Headhunter. And Royal 16 is Jag Fell in a Z-95 Headhunter. Great list, Harry. Thank you very much for sharing Royal Squadron with me. Now, listener, if you have a Star Wars character group you'd like to share, a fighter squadron, Mount Rushmore, road trip crew, Sabacc game, mixtape, or if I've said something you disagree with, email me at swlegendslounge@gmail.com or send me a tweet at legendslounge1. And of course, send me your questions, your unpopular opinions. I love hearing from everyone. Now, coming up on the next episode, we'll be sticking with the scum and villainy with The Bounty Hunter Wars, The Mandalorian Armor by H.W. Jeter. You can look forward to that episode coming out on May 3rd. Thank you so much for listening to the Star Wars Legends Lounge. I'm Aaron Motes. May the Force be with you. And remember, there's always a bit of truth in Legends.